So this morning I'm going to give my second talk. Gave a first talk last week on the three vehicles in Buddhist practice. So I'll talk briefly about what I talked about last week, and then go over the third vehicle. Talk about the third vehicle. So the three vehicles, the yanas, are talked about in the literature a lot. And there are vehicles that we take on this path that we've undertaken. We've decided to embark on it if we're doing a meditation practice. And last time I talked about the vehicle of the solitary practitioner and the vehicle of the listener who is involved in... You guys can get good seats, can't you? I'm gonna pause so you guys find nice seats for yourself. So I talk about those two. And just really briefly, the solitary practitioner goes all the way back to Buddha himself, who practiced in a solitary way by himself. Really, we can only do this. This practice is about kind of our own minds, our own psyches, and we have to spend some time in solitary. Even the active sitting meditation, it's in solitary. You're doing it by yourself. I talked last time about the monks in Bhutan, and seeing them up around the mountains when I was there. I didn't actually see them. I just saw their little huts. They said, so-and-so's up there. He's up there for 9 months. So-and-so's up there. He's up there for 12 months. And I talked a little bit about Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma, 9 years sitting in that cave. That's not a solitary practice. What is? 9 years sitting there without any doing any ritual, without... doing any reading, apparently. so goes the story. Cave practice also is the earliest practice, as far as we know, the earliest practice. And I talk about Thoreau as an American example of someone who did a solitary practice. Then last time I also talked about and that's the pracheka practice. Last time I also talked about the second practice, the practice of the listener, the shravaka. That's most of us. We practice together. We practice with a teacher. And we do that because we need support. And that's the vehicle we choose to do that. And some of us may move back and forth between these two vehicles. We may be affiliated for a while and really work with a teacher and really be part of a sangha and get that support, and then we may go off on our own and practice for a while. So we move back and forth between those two vehicles. And don't forget that those vehicles are not to accomplish anything, right? This isn't about accomplish anything. This is about coming from out there, which is samsara, to right here, which is nirvana, right here. Just the simple act of being here in a non-grasping, non-clinging way. So that's pretty much a review of what I talked about last time. In the discussion, people brought up the fact that Thoreau had Emerson as a partner. So he had his little sangha. That's pretty good. He did. I could have said that Bodhidharma actually had years of practicing with a teacher before he went to China, which he did. So those are the two complement one another. And the third one, the Bodhisattva one, is what I'm going to talk about today, which some of you are very familiar with. If you're new to Zen Center, you might not even know the term, though. Bodhisattva, it really means helping others who are suffering. Very simple. Helping, going where the suffering is and helping other people. So where does Bodhisattva practice begin? Well, with empathy. And we all have a propensity to develop empathy. Some of us develop more than others. And, of course, Zen meditation helps us develop empathy, but it's not everything, not the be all and end all. Part of it is the way is acculturation and practice. I got back from spending time with my grandsons. Was that a little over a week ago? 10 days ago. Well, my 4-year-old grandson, I would say, is I was just watching him see how his empathy is developing. Trying to support him, you know. He doesn't have much empathy for his 10-month-old or his 11-month-old brother to be a year this year. Doesn't have much empathy for him because he feels like he feels a little jealous. He feels a little competitive, right? These are human. It's hard to be empathic with someone we feel a little jealousy of, a little competitiveness with. He feels empathy with his cat. His cat, no jealousy there, no competitiveness there. His cat's been really sick, really ill. So he's very sweet about taking care of Minu. Yeah, Minu, whatever. That's it. Well, forget that. But anyway, Minu is what they call it. So he's there for the cat. And the cat died recently. Minu died. And when I saw my grandson Ethan, Ethan was feeling really sad about the cat. And his so I was thinking about the cat and then his brother, you know. And that's just human for us, isn't it? That's just kind of the way we are. We feel like someone is moving into our area. It's hard for us to be empathic. But if we're still in ourselves and people aren't encroaching on us, it's fairly simple. Fairly simple. So I took my grandson to the park one day, and my grandkids live in Paris. And I don't speak any French, and my grandson's supposed to be learning French, although they only speak English to him at home. But so he's pretty shy in public. He doesn't really talk in public because of the language barrier. But maybe he's just shy. But we were in the park, this great big park, and a mother cat came out who would look quite emaciated, and she, you know, her breasts were hanging down, and she looked, and right away Ethan, who had been playing with his soldiers and his gun, got really quiet, and he said, "Oh, you know, like a cat, he really felt for the cat. He could see the cat was suffering, so he went over to the people who were having a picnic next to us. This shy little 4-year-old boy, he went over, and he saw that they had some food. And he went over and he stood by them, and he said, and I couldn't hear what he said. Anyway, I think he spoke French. He must have. And pretty soon, they were giving him food, and he was feeding the little mama cat over in the bushes. That's empathy. So we want to encourage that in ourselves and in others. There can be no bodhisattva without empathy. There can be no compassionate action without empathy. And when I first got this evening, when I first arrived, I brought my wife, and my daughter told me to bring two knights for my grandson, knights, because my grandson already likes knights and soldiers. He doesn't like dolls, but he likes knights, soldiers, cars, and planes. He did this before. I was saying to Susan yesterday, he did this before anybody acculturated him into anything. We tried to acculturate him the opposite way. But there you go. He's a little boy. And so Linda bought the two knights. I brought the two knights with me. I guess they're part of a set. And I gave him the two knights, and he looked at the two knights, and he said, "Isn't there more?" "Isn't there more?" And, you know, Linda carefully packed these for me, 10 days ahead of time. "Isn't there more?" And his mother said, "Ethan." His mother said, "Ethan, Grandma and Grandpa brought these all the way for you. Aren't they wonderful?" And he just looked at her. He said, "Mama, I wanted more." And then my wife said, She said, "Oh, it's really hard, isn't it, when you're expecting something wonderful and you don't get what you want? I mean, don't you really feel let down and disappointed?" So my wife was able to be empath, and then he just stopped. And just, my wife, and then my daughter said, "Oh, Mom, that was good." because it was good. It was empathic. The mother was trying to teach. The mother was kind of pissed at her son, right? She identified with her son. Sometimes when we're close to people, it's harder for us to be empathic with them because we expect them to, they should be a certain way. As my priest in training, you should be a certain way. So it might be harder for me. It might be harder for me if I carry that around. So those are a couple of things that I think we need to pay attention to in regard to empathy. There's a fellow at Harvard named George Vaillant, V-A-I-L-L-A-N-T, maybe that's Vaillant, who just finished a study, which you guys may have read about, over 60 years. And he studied 800 people from adolescence to old age. Now, this was a self-selected group in that they were all Harvard. They all went to Harvard. But other than that, he tried to get a cross-section. So, and there was only one factor that over that long time period that related to successful aging, and it was the capacity for empathic relationships. The people who developed and maintained the capacity for empathic relationships. Nothing to do with intelligence, nothing to do with how well they did in their career, nothing about the quality of their meditation or their prayer, but the quality and the capacity for empathic relationship. So that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Kind of interesting. The usual definition of compassion and then compassion action of the bodhisattva is suffering with. We're suffering with. Ethan was suffering with that little kitty. But if we look at what Buddha said himself, oh, we don't really know if he said it, but it's in the scriptures, he said that he talked about a trembling of the heart and then a pleasant sense of care. So the trembling of the heart is the empathy, the empathic feeling, and then how do we deal with that feeling? Can we hold that distress in such a way as to be helpful, to do something helpful? Because if we don't hold it in a way that allows us to do something helpful and actually do something helpful, it's not compassion, really. So that's pretty interesting. That's pretty interesting. So what are the different things that we do instead of be fully compassionate? We have the initial empathy, but then somehow something happens. Well, here are three things that we do that kind of short-circuit the process. One thing, we freeze. We freeze. So last night, I went to the theater downtown with my wife, and we were at the parking, and we parked, and we got out, and we went in the street, and a homeless guy came up. The guy came up on a cart, kind of. He must have been disabled. He had one of those mobile carts, you know. So it makes it especially difficult. Came over and asked for support and started talking, as is often the case, about his wife and his family. And I froze. And I mean, the interesting thing is that my vocation is to work with homeless people. That's my vocation. I've started lots and lots of programs with homeless people. I've known a lot of homeless people, but I froze. My wife did not freeze. She got up, got out a dollar, and gave him a dollar, and then he went on. It was one of those coin dollars. So first he looked at it and thought it was just a quarter, and kind of looked up at her, and she said, "Oh, it's a dollar." And I'm not saying that what she did was cool or anything, but she didn't freeze. When we find ourselves freezing, that's a good time for us to sort of be mindful, see what's going on, usually there's something clogged up from our past, from our ideas about who we should be. The second thing that we do is one I talk about a lot. We do what the Tibetans call idiot compassion, right? Idiot compassion means that we give someone a second chance, a third chance, a fourth chance, a fifth chance, a sixth chance, but we're not giving them chances. We're enabling, because we're not really holding them accountable. We're not really drawing a line. And if we have to keep giving the same chance over and over again, then there's something that's not okay about us and them. So that idiot compassion, I think, is the second one. The third one is that we get discouraged and burnt out. Especially social workers get discouraged and burnt out, but also psychologists. People who are... And I'm speaking from experience. Maybe you and other professions get just as discouraged and burnt out. But that's what I've done for my life, is first a social worker and then a psychologist. And so what's going on there? Well, I think what's going on there is maybe not enough zazen, not enough just sitting and quieting the mind. Also, I think maybe what's going on in my case, I noticed when I was young, one of my first jobs was to work with a huge group of serious and persistently mentally ill people. One of my first jobs. And I, after a year, I was just ready to leave. I went into it with an open heart and lots of sincerity, and I did my zazen every day. But after a year, I just wanted to go. And I checked it out with myself. I paid attention. And I noticed that this was my expectation. I expected these people to change, to get better. And I set up all these things for them to do, all these different programs, and they didn't follow through. So it was me. It was about my expectation and my need to have people improve in a certain way. Well, improve or not improve. This is life. We're just all living the best way we can. And so I was trying to accomplish something, and that was covering over my ability just to respond empathically in a compassionate way and actually do something. So I did learn to dial down over the years. So I think bodhisattva practice also should use it to open up to our own suffering. Now, this is not so classic, more classical, someone else's suffering. But I think our own suffering. Hey, we suffer a lot. So open up to our own suffering. Be empathic. Be strong enough to do something based on that empathy. To respond rather than react based on that empathy. Example for this morning is example of my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. I remember someone asked him what he suffered the most about, and he said, "Oh, war." Well, he'd been in Japan in World War II, and it had been an awful experience, as it was for everybody who was probably in Japan. I'm sure it was an awful experience, and one of the reasons he wanted to come to the United States was that he felt the Japanese had gotten Buddhism wrong. They'd gone down a wrong path in regard to their Buddhism. Their Buddhism had, they let their Buddhism become militaristic. Not all of them, but, here was the predominant. Militaristic, used a calming the mind to actually harm people. And this is something that he carried around with him. And one reason he wanted to go to America, because he thought it could be different here. And I can remember when we had the Vietnam War, and he came back from I don't know where he was flying, from being on an airplane, and he said, there were soldiers. He said, the plane was full of soldiers, and he said, oh, I felt so bad. He said, I just think we need to practice zazen more. So... Well, that was his own suffering that he was motivated him. So Buddhism in this country is pretty young. We're pretty young. We're 50, 60 years old. We don't have institutions yet, like Catholic Charities or Lutheran Social Services or these organizations that really do minister to people suffering. But we'll, and also we're a very small minority. But we will develop those, I'm sure. Already we have people working in hospices. There's a homeless program that Bernie Glassman has set up. We've got a group here who are working in prisons. It just started about three or four months ago. And, gee, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. So we will, but maybe it will be another 50 or 100 years. Meanwhile, day to day, we can do it, day to day. Probably one of the most important, one of the people whom I think is the most bodhisattva-like is a guy named Harry. What's the way he's smiling at Harry? Oh yeah, well his name is Harry. And this guy is the let's see. This guy came to the Twin Cities from Los Angeles in 1968 or something. He was a realtor. And then he went into the Presbyterian ministry. And he became a Presbyterian minister because he said he had a calling to help people. And then he was told he could, there was a church in the inner city in St. Paul that he could come to, which was very broken down, very dilapidated. So he moved his family from Southern California in their nice realty house to the inner city of St. Paul, to this church, and started just ministering. And I probably talked about this before, but one of the first things he noticed was people in the neighborhood. This was the Selby Dale neighborhood, which used to be a very, very rough neighborhood. People, he noticed around the streets, people, a lot of street people, way back in 1969. And they seemed to be talking to themselves, they seemed to be disoriented. He didn't know anything about it. So what did he do? He went down to the basement of the church, he cleaned out the basement, he put ashtrays all around the basement, and he put three coffee pots in the basement and opened up the doors. And he was not a smoker. And he didn't drink coffee, but he was empathic, and then he acted on his empathy. Then he became a real pioneer in the Twin Cities in reaching out to people with who were homeless and people with mental illness, and hundreds and hundreds of people are now getting help and support just because of those actions he did back there. So. And he knows nothing about Zazen at all, or Buddha at all. And he doesn't talk much about God. Thank goodness. Although he does talk about having a calling. Oh, that's wonderful. Whatever that is, that's wonderful. If we're called to help someone, gee, what more can we ask for? And he's 84 now, and he just got back from Guatemala, where he's working with refugees down there. I don't know how much longer he's going to last, but... So, in Tibetan Buddhism and in some forms of Buddhism, there is conscious bodhisattva practice. You take on conscious practices that you do to stretch yourself and become more bodhisattva-like. Not so much in Zen. One conscious bodhisattva practice is, I'm working with my Rinpoche, my Zen teacher, my Tibetan Buddhist teacher, for instance. And he said, and we decide, or maybe he decides, well, you know, it's a guru tradition, so it's more like he decides. So he decides that I need to focus on giving things and money away. So that becomes my practice, and I just focus on that. And I have this on my mind because I read something from Gelug Rinpoche about this about 3 weeks ago. And he said, when you're doing this kind of practice, you should feel a little pinch when you give something away. That pinch is your stinginess protesting. If you give away your old, worn-out coat that you wouldn't be caught dead wearing, that's not generosity. There is no pinch. You are doing nothing to overcome your stinginess. You're just cleaning up your closet and calling it something else. Giving away your coat might keep someone warm, but it does not address the problem we face as spiritual practitioners, to free ourselves from self-cherishing and self-grasping. So that's interesting, isn't it? That's interesting. And it made me think about why we don't do more of those practices, why Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi didn't teach us those practices, and why we don't do those practices more. And I'm not sure why, except there's a danger in those practices, and the danger is the danger of a lot of measurement, a lot of evaluation, a lot of guilt, a lot of we're trying to calm down this internal dialogue. We're trying to free ourselves a little bit from the hypnosis of this dialogue. Well, if we just start a new dialogue, which is, am I doing this right? How should I do this? Was this person grateful? Should I give it more? Then we've got a whole new hypnotic sense, fictional self to deal with. And so, yes, do it, but be careful, is what I would say. Be careful. Be careful. Maybe better even to pay attention, as I try to do, to not to get in any program, but just pay attention when stinginess comes up. When stinginess comes up, there's always clinging to something we're afraid we're going to lose. So just paying attention to that. What's that? What's that? What's going on there? What's going on? What's my need? It's the voice telling me. It's just a voice, but if I can see it, there's a chance to be free from it. Or maybe it's not a voice. Maybe it's just a feeling in my chest. Oh, Linda gave away $1. No, I didn't do that. But I feel, you know, maybe. How about if she gave away $100? Oh, Linda, et cetera, right? So it could be part of our practice without developing the program. But if you were to work with a teacher who gives you a program, that's cool too. But I won't give you one. Because that's just not the way I do things. And I won't give myself one either. Rumi said... Rumi says to my Uncle Al, my Uncle Al was a guy who was really, one of his major values was helping people and supporting people. He was wonderful, and we all loved him, but he got so entangled in people's lives. And he seemed to carry a sort of a burden of their lives around with him. There wasn't a lack of lightness. And the more generous he was, the more entangled he seemed to get. So Rumi would say to my Uncle Al, "You have forgotten about the I who doesn't care about ownership, who doesn't try to turn a profit from any human exchange. Any human exchange, including the human exchange of being a good boy, or being a good girl, being a good Zen master, a good teacher. Yes, we should be a boy, a girl, a teacher, but let's not get into this good and bad stuff too much. When we see ourselves doing that, let's just go slow and come back to just being with what is. Why do we need to be good? Can't we just really open up to what is and fully be? And if we fully are, then Can we trust that? Can we trust our ability just to fully be, and that if we fully are, we won't take advantage of people? We won't take advantage of ourselves? So that's the third yana. That's the third vehicle. And after I talked about the first two vehicles last time, someone came up and talked to me, and they said, well, that was interesting to hear about the first two vehicles, and I already know about the third vehicle, so I don't have to come this I don't have to come next time. Well, they were being frank, right? I don't have to. They said, but this person said, but I'm still uncertain. I'm still uncertain and confused. I said, yeah, you're uncertain and confused. You're uncertain and confused. Okay. We would rather be certain, wouldn't we? We would rather be certain. We would all rather be certain. But nirvana, according to Buddhism, is nothing other than the reality of non-grasping, the reality of non-clinging. Is there certainty in non-grasping and non-clinging? Try it and tell me if there's any certainty there. So maybe it's okay. Maybe it's okay to be uncertain and just open up to it. Open up to it. Maybe we can see things in a little more slowed down way, in a little more open way, if we're not certain. And we can try these different yanas, we can try these different vehicles, and not get too attached on whether we're doing the right one or the wrong one, or going the right direction or the wrong direction. Because these are just pointers to help us point back to the path, so that we can cool ourselves down, and just be present with life. Whether it's my own frozenness when my wife gives $100 to the homeless person, I'm going to tell my wife I wasn't planning on doing this, you know. or a cat who's really desperately in need of food, and move in this world and be present. And remembering also that the yanas, the three yanas, the bodhisattva yana, without a little bit of the other two yanas, it's hard to be because the mind is so caught up in grasping and clinging, if you don't do a practice, which is one of the first two, it's very hard to do the third in a thorough way. Very hard. Because it's always about you. You don't think it's about you, but it is. But if you calm down through one of the first two practices, or through complement of the first two vehicles, it will really help you with the third one. And of course, the proof of the pudding of your sitting, of your meditation, is the third one. Now, don't measure, but it's still the proof of the pudding. It's still the proof of the pudding in the eating, in the being, in the giving. And of course, in Buddhism, we say, give with a threefold purity. It's so idealistic that I even hate to say it, because you'll all try to do it. But anyway, give with no thought of giver, gift, or act of giving. But if you really go into these first two practices, sometimes this will happen in life. Sometimes it will happen because there'll be a sense of natural connectedness, natural openness. Okay. What do you guys have this morning? Anybody want to talk about the uncertainty of this? Yeah, Matt.
So, I mostly agree with what you said.
Oh, okay.
But I just think it's interesting that you criticize the program of generosity.
Yeah.
But it seems like you could equally criticize the program of zazen and how easy it is for that to become all about you.
That's right.
And you're very careful the way you teach zazen.
Yeah.
And so if somebody was very careful the way they taught the generosity practice.
I think you're exactly right. You know, hang out with this guy. Yeah. And you know, that has to do with my own experience. We're all limited by our own experience. I have a certain experience, Tibetan practitioners have had another experience, and it limits us. So, and that's just the way human beings are. Anything else? What else? Yeah. Could you guys hear her? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's hard. I think if you can check in with yourself and ask yourself why you're doing this, and see if it's based on some need you have. Try to be as transparent with yourself as possible and as ruthlessly honest with yourself as possible, and check into whether there's some need that you have to keep propping so-and-so up, to keep giving so-and-so, when it's probably better not to prop her up anymore, just because you're doing her a disservice. I think that's the best thing. And I think that's the best way to do it, but that's not foolproof either. Yeah. Other people? Yeah. Well, as I said, we haven't developed any institutional action here yet in the United States. But yes, there's a Buddhist Peace Fellowship. There's a homeless group started by Bernie Glassman that turned into a whole huge project in New York City. The call to action comes from our empathy, and Buddhist activism is a distinct possibility for any of us who do this practice, but it's action without as much as possible without bristling, and when we find ourselves bristling, then it doesn't mean we don't take the action, because if we wait and sit in our cushions for 50 years and get deeply enlightened and say, oh, we're going to help people then, it's going to be too late. So the call for action is now. Environmentally, politically, socially, war. It's now. And as our practice calms down, we're able to do that in a more congruent way, a more integrated way. And without worrying so much about the results. We'll just try and try and try, because each effort is the first one. But Buddhism has been criticized historically for not engaging in enough social action by people like Robert Aiken, who's kind of one of the pioneers of Buddhist social action in the West. Anything else?